And now, your Chilpack Hollywood Hour with Dean Haglund and Phil Lairness.
Phil, Dean, what will it be today? Now intercontinental, LA to Australia. It's your Chilpack Hollywood Hour. It's your Chilpack Hollywood Hour.
Celebrity deaths.
Dean Haglund.
Phil Lairness.
Did you see that Dr. Oliver Sacks died?
I did see that. Author of The Man Who Mistook His Wife for a Hat.
I'm glad that you referenced that one. Yeah, that's fascinating. Of course, so many people know him as the inspiration behind Robin Williams' character in Awakenings.
Absolutely. And to think that that book that I just referenced also was made into an opera, of all things. I believe he's the only psychologist to have his work made into an opera. You'll have to reference that, but that might be true.
Well, wait, I think there was if I'm not mistaken, last year at the Bowl, I saw the L.A. Phil perform the Freud opera, Mommy, Mommy, Why'd You Do It to Me? But
that's not an opera.
Anyway, I can't believe that we've gone so far afield in celebrity deaths. I mean, usually we're quite solemn on the occasion. It was fascinating to me and actually heartening how many people were touched by the death of Dr. Sacks, not only in public and on the Twitter sphere, but among our listeners who actually expressed hope that we would remember him.
Ah, that's so nice, because often we keep it to the celebrity realm and not go into the medical profession.
We do talk about books less often than we would like and less often than we used to. And of course, if only tangentially, as we mentioned, the Academy Award nominated film Awakenings does make Dr. Sacks a show business celebrity. And it's hard to think about this death, quite frankly, so short after the anniversary of Robin Williams' suicide without thinking of Robin Williams,
who played basically Dr. Oliver Sacks in Awakening.
Yeah.
And you say it was Oscar nominated? Who was the nominee for an Oscar in that thing?
I think the film was, and maybe even Robin Williams. I didn't look into it because, again, I thought we'd be talking more about Oliver Sacks, but here we are talking about Robin Williams. And quite frankly, why not? Because it is interesting, isn't it, that Robin Williams, not surprising, I don't say surprising, I think it's very interesting, very telling, and as we've discussed acting in some depth over the recent weeks and honestly, since this show began 9 years ago, it's telling and it really makes a lot of sense that Robin Williams, in retrospect, would gravitate towards a role like Dr. Sacks, like the psychiatrist that he did win the Oscar for playing in Good Will Hunting, and and on the other hand, would gravitate towards figures that themselves were dealing with mental illnesses, like in The Fisher King. Robin Williams, as an actor, was coming at this issue of mental health from a variety of different angles. And maybe it's because it interested him with his own, life struggles. Or it might just be another case that is also true of the roles mirroring the actor back to himself.
Ah, fascinating. Which is often what Oliver Sacks would do, is look at the creative person and see how they were helping, fixing, or compensating for whatever issues they may have had. I know he went on a lengthy article about Robin Williams saying that if he didn't have his performance behind him, he would be in quite some trouble.
Well, and that's a great point. I mean, also for people who, you know, obviously, understandably wish, oh, you know, it's too bad that Robin battled this. It's too bad that, you know, Robin killed himself, of course. On the other hand, if Robin Williams was different than he was, we wouldn't have gotten the performances that we did.
That's exactly right.
And, you know, it's one of the things that I talk about in my acting class with my students is, you know, before you let go of a role, after you've performed it, after, you know, the audition, whatever it is, no matter how long a run it was, or if it was just, like I said, one audition, make sure you ask yourself, you know, what did this character have to teach you about yourself? Because if you can, first of all, it's important, because if you don't, I think, put closure on a performance like that, let's say it's a role you've played for a long time, that character might stick around for a long time. I know that sounds crazy, but, you know, to live in the energy of another being, it is something that really can affect an actor if they don't realize, wow, I didn't let go of it. I didn't go through that process of really, you know, letting go of such a different energy or a different emotional range. But also, I think it's a way to just release it with gratitude, to say, now, what did this character have to teach me about myself, maybe as an actor or as a person, or both? And if you do that, the fascinating thing is, I really believe that actor or that character, once released, will nevertheless stay close by within arm's length so that someday on a future project, if you need to call them forward because there's something similar that you're exploring, they'll be there for you.
Yeah, it's true. And you know, when you go into hard characters or difficult, deeply emotional scenes, you want to have a technique where you can let go of that so you can get back to your daily life of buying groceries and doing the laundry and that sort of thing, you know?
Yeah.
You see a lot of that, I don't know if I'm going to point out method acting in particular, but that was clearly a problem that they had no technique of letting go once they really got into the deep emotional hardships, that there was no external technique to get them out of that.
You know, I can't help wondering, even though, you know, we're talking about acting, which is a different field than Dr. Sachs, but I can't help wondering if this is something, a process that he actually could have used. Because, you know, you read the fact that he dies of cancer. And not just cancer, but cancer of the eyes that spreads to the liver.
Yeah, there's a connection.
And, you know, cancer, as Louise Hay has written so many times before, is, you know, it's an unexpressed deep hurt that you're holding on to. You know, some kind of deep-seated resentment, some kind of deep secret, some kind of deep grief, and you're not expressing it. And if you don't express it, you can't ever process it and let it go.
Right.
And so you think about all the work that he was doing as a neurosurgeon and the patients he was dealing with, and did he really stop to do the work of how that might be mirroring things for himself?
Wow.
And was he letting go? Was he processing all of this and letting it go? I can't know, obviously.
I can't know either. One would hope that by writing books and stuff like that, that was a process of dealing with it.
But certainly, you know, you die, you know, you get eye cancer. I mean, eye problems themselves, you know, the obvious question is, well, what is it that this person is afraid to look at? What is it that they're not looking at? And then for it to spread to the liver, which is all about anger, which is all about unexpressed anger and frustration, you know, I can't, it really does feel like that ties in with the work that he was doing, you know? There's a quote from him, and of course he was a brilliant man. I like this when his, you know, when he realized that the end was near, he said, after announcing his diagnosis with terminal cancer, "Above all, I have been a sentient being, a thinking animal on this beautiful planet, and that in itself has been an enormous privilege and adventure.
Aww, how fantastic.
Wow, that's it's great when you can way. Yeah, when you can leave your own epitaph, your own eulogy.
Yeah.
That's the way to do it, man.
That's the way to do it. Put that on my tombstone.
Hey, before we move on to more Hollywood-esque topics,
wow.
I have heard a couple of health and nutrition kind of statements of fact over the last week, one of them in my acting class, and I had to run these by you, okay?
Please do.
The first was, apparently much is being made out of the fact that we culturally have overestimated how much water a person needs to consume on a daily basis. That 8 ounces, you know, eight glasses of 8 ounces water is ridiculously overestimating it, according to scientists now, that really it's just you only need to drink liquids when you're thirsty.
Well, I'd say yes and no. There is a one's thirst level can be tempered over time to you not realizing where your thirst level's at. I think the 8 glasses was arbitrarily dished out, if you would mind the pun, back when there was during the food pyramid, and just 8 was a number that they all agreed upon. Where they came from that, there was not that much research, but it was the idea that drink more water than Coca-Cola or sugary drinks or, you know, fizzy things. That was the idea there. So if people were on average drinking 4 to 6, you know, Cokes a day, then by all means drink more water than that. I think that's where that number came from. But indeed, I think it's individual. It's up to one person. I do a yoga practice called Puma Shustra.
Right, which I used to do for a while when we used to share office together over in the days of Cinema Arts Entertainment and Rational Exuberance. I was doing that as well.
Yes, a liter and a half every morning within a 15-minute time window. And weight loss and all sorts of things happened, including frequent bathroom breaks. But yeah,
that was the thing, and I didn't mind it when I had an office job. It was an excuse to get up from the desk. Now take me to your liter and a half later, and I'll anyway. Well, I'm glad that what you say makes reasonable sense, because I got to tell you, maybe it's from hanging around with you too long. Maybe it's from making the truth is out there. But when I first heard this, and from my students who were calling in my acting class, who were calling my attention to these scientific reports, I said, huh, we're hearing that we're drinking too much water right when we're here in California in the midst of a historic drought with no end in sight, right when globally the largest El Nino of all time threatens to leave a third of the population of this planet without water in a very short amount of time. Huh, they're telling us we don't need as much water. Wonder why that is.
Right, because then you're not going to be panicking, I suppose.
Well, we're not going to be drinking water, which we don't have.
Well, that's handy.
But you're saying I don't need as much anyway.
Well, I think it's up to the individual, really. You really got to listen to your body, really suss it out, know exactly what it feels like to be dehydrated, where that level is, and work from there accordingly. At the same time, you know, there's this doctor who's called Dr. Aqua or whatever.
Is that
I'm
in
not kidding.
That's a character in BoJack Horseman.
It sure is. And but he has turned around liver disease, people going in for all sorts of operations just by accelerating the amount of water they drink. And that's his only prescription. And he's reversed illnesses on quite a few of his patients. So there's that aspect to being dehydrated, comes with it a bunch of other illnesses. So it's important at the same time to go, oh, yeah, you can chuck out the idea of 8 glasses of water. Also realize that underwatering your body can also lead to a bunch of problems as well.
Now, I'm a huge fan of kale. I love kale. I mean, kale is not only a superfood. I mean, I would have it with butter and syrup if I could. I love it so much. Harper's Bazaar runs a big article about, really, you need to cut out the kale.
Well, not cut out. It picks up from the soil, dangerous, whatever the soil has in terms of heavy metals, trace elements, all of that sort of thing, which makes it a superfood in the first place. It gets nutrients from the soil that are directly into the plant itself.
But apparently this one's the real tough one. And like people who eat kale every day, which I was getting to the point of, have, you know, seven times the level of these poisons in their body of what is healthy, of what is acceptable.
And it's bioaccumulative, so it actually stays in there
forever,
like arsenic and mercury. Yeah. So, but here is the lesson then, again, of all of these stories of superfoods, of all of this Pumashustra, all things in moderation. That is the what we should walk away from with all our health and eating food news is, now and then you can have a pizza. Yeah, kale is good. So are beets and nuts and all those sort of things. But if they just say, here's the eight superfoods that you'll live forever, and you just eat those eight superfoods every day over and over again, you're going to die just as fast as if you're going to McDonald's every day. So I say moderate and have a wide range of stuff. And
so what were the superfoods? They were kale.
Kale, yeah. Almonds, walnuts, I believe.
Sweet potatoes or no?
Sweet or blueberries.
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 The Wonder Twins?
The Wonder. No, I don't think they're a food source anymore. I think that was just they were
form of an iceberg, form of kale poisoning. Okay. Foods that'll kill us and having no water on the planet and brilliant thinkers who are dead, let's lighten the mood a little bit by talking about the latest big publicized gun shooting in America. Have you seen the footage of the Virginia on-air news shooting?
You know what? Growing up, I sort of never watched a snuff film. And so I was trying to keep that record going by trying not to see live on-air killings in video footage if I can avoid it. And often I can, because there's a giant triangle in front of that, over top of that picture where it says live footage of a killing on air. Press this triangle to watch, and I don't do that.
Might I suggest that when you were young, you set your levels of accomplishment very low? if your goal was, as a kid, I would like to avoid watching snuff films as long as I can. I think most of us, that's not even in our realm of things we're going for. But, granted, you were, you come from the snowy, blistery, Arctic cold. So, whatever keeps you warm at night.
Well, exactly. And consider how hard that goal is to achieve these days.
I guess you're right. So in other words, it wasn't that you aimed low. It was that you were dogged by cunning foresight. You foresaw everything culturally, including the internet. Okay. Well, yeah. Never mind snuff films. I'm getting to the point, right, where there's so much gunplay in movies. I just want to walk out on. But I did watch this video of the news reporter getting killed, on camera, getting attacked. And it's a 30-second clip. And it is hugely disturbing. So I don't advocate anyone watching this. But as your friend in podcasting, let me point out a few things that I was struck by, because God knows we don't have any more to add a controlled debate. Other than at some point, can we stop misrepresenting the Second Amendment? Anyway, that said, there were three things in it that really got my interest outside of the violence. The first is that the interview begins, and it's all about what can be done to draw, I'm laughing, it's not funny, but draw increased tourism to that area. That's the discussion that's taking place, how increased tourism will be good for the economy. And as soon as they say that, bang, 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 shots are fired. Now, I guess this is four things, by the way, that I notice. What happens immediately thereafter is the camera falls to the ground because the cameraman's taken one to the back of the head.
Right.
I don't read a lot about, if anything, about a camera person having been shot and killed. It's about the news reporter.
Oh, down here, it's both of them are shown side by side, two pictures.
I must say that in response to seeing this, and in response to IFC advertising their second episode of Documentary Now, an episode that, as you know, I'd already seen and panned on last week's Chill Pack Hollywood Hour, I tried to start a little bit of a campaign to get IFC not to air that episode because, quite frankly, if it ever was funny in the wake of the Virginia shooting, I don't think seeing TV news camera people taking gunshots to the head is all that funny. And yet it's something that IFC audiences were treated to in the comedy series Documentary Now. Anyway, getting back to this video, the cameraman goes down, the camera falls, you see blood droplet spray in front of the camera. We cut back to the anchor woman in the news studio who is understandably looks shocked and disturbed and says, we don't know what just happened there. As soon as we think we know what those sounds might have been, really? As you know, we've just seen all the same thing. Somebody fall, camera hit the ground, blood come out, and we heard the gunshots. But as soon as we think we know what those sounds might be, we'll go back to the location. But turning to other stories, the power of social media. And then they launch into a story about the power of social media. So there's 30 seconds where life is lost. That is bookended about the need for tourism to increase our economy and the power of social media to make our life better. If that 30 seconds does not capsulize where we're at culturally, I don't know 30 seconds that will.
Wow. That is kind of a tight bookend. To be fair, of course, I think the announcer did the right thing, because there's so many times that you would speculate, oh my God, they've been shot, ladies and gentlemen, we're Nancy, they've been shot. And then you find out nobody was shot. It was a car backfire and the guy fell over.
All right. Well, I would argue, though, that they didn't do the right thing. I would argue you hold on all stories at that point, because anyone watching at that point is sure to be potentially traumatized. I think you need to stay there. You need to try to calm people down. You need to say, look, we don't know. We need to say exactly what you just said. But we can't just say we'll get back to the elephant in the room once we figure out which is its trunk, which is its tail.
Well, clearly there's a floor producer, as we know, being on morning shows, calling the shots on what's going on and what to do.
I think so, calling the shots may be a poor choice of words.
Ah, see, that is a poor choice. Well done. So I believe the floor producer just said, okay, carry on to the next story, while everybody was freaking out in the edit room and the control room, including what I heard, the fiance of the cameraman in the control room witnessing it right in the edit bay.
Obviously, look, Monday morning quarterback, it is very easy for me to criticize. At the same time, I think you would agree with me that we are not in an age of the most fossil responsible journalists. And we're not in an age where adults, mature, responsible adults, seem to be calling the shots. We're not in a time where seasoned experience is stepping forward or able to step forward in these moments. So I do understand why there was a failing here. Nevertheless, I would like to go on record, Dean Haglund, as saying that this was a failing, because I do think it would be important for someone to step forward at that moment and say, look, we all saw what you just saw. None of us know what this is. We're going to stay here. We're not going to go to a commercial. We're not going to go to another story. We're not going to pretend that everything is business as usual. We're going to try to find out what we can. And I think it's all right if there's silence. I think it's all right. You know, the show is irrevocably changed at that moment. So go on doesn't mean quite what it meant 30 seconds earlier.
Well, that's true. So I think you should now apply to be a floor producer at a morning news show.
Well, I just ask myself, you know, in the wake of this and in the wake of IFC, I think probably not even thinking about, because let's face it, the programming people probably don't even watch these shows, or the marketing people don't watch these shows they're tweeting and advertising about. But again, the decision to the very next day air this thing about TV news journalists getting themselves and their camera people killed, it maybe isn't so funny if it ever was before. Now, let me, in all fairness, acknowledge that I did give the first episode of Documentary Now a try after I roundly panned episode two. And you know that I love Fred Armisen. Portlandia is one of my favorite shows. I love Bill Hader. I think he's a brilliant actor. His performance in Skeleton Twins was one of my favorite last year. And I got to say, their parody of Grey Gardens called Sandy Passage, which was all really a mashup of Grey Gardens and the Blair Witch Project, was
fantastic.
Absolutely brilliant. It was every bit as brilliant as that second episode failed to be. So definitely check it out. It is so wonderfully funny. But still, I have to ask myself when people, you know, are doing these things, like, hey, if we learn anything, we'll let you know. But let's talk about social media. I scratch my head wondering, has the world gone mad? And maybe it has, because here's a letter, Dean Haglund, that you and I received.
Okay.
Hi.
Hi.
A friend has suggested you check out a great website, www.nolongerlonely.com. Okay, now clearly we're getting, I think, you know, unless you and I have a joint dating account somewhere, we're now getting, and by the way, that website would be where podcast hosts meet.com, but we got spam, and I don't usually read the spam on the show, but I had to, because what follows this, quote, friend suggesting that we check out a great website, nolongerlonely.com, it says the website is designed to help folks struggling with mental illness find companionship.
Wow. Okay.
So a dating site set up to make money off lonely hearted people with mental illness.
Well, let's think about that for a moment. I guess that is a service, and perhaps it is under marketed, shall I say, an under marketed segment of the population.
Here is the profile that was suggested to us.
Okay.
Someone we might want to meet. And, you know, in the wake of course, Ashley Madison's website, I love that Ashley Madison gets exposed as a fraud. And I had only found out about this thing, I think John Oliver and Lily Holloman had to explain to me that this thing was real. Ashley Madison was a website, right, for people who were married and wanted to have affairs. And then it turns out that all the female profiles were made up, and it was a way of getting personal information from the men who would sign up for this. I love, though, the concept that, you know, there used to be laws on the book, by the way, in this country, certainly, against alienation of affection. If you were found guilty of trying to drive a wedge between people who were married, you were guilty of something called alienation of affection. Not only do we not have laws against this, but apparently you can make good money doing that exact thing. Is this a great country or what?
Wait, that was on the law books?
Yeah, alienation of affection was in certain places a crime. And uh-huh. So anyway, this is the person. And so I don't know if you tell me if you want me to reach out, you know, maybe not romantically, but maybe we just want to be friends. My name is Leroy Petrie. I enjoy meeting new people and their way of life. I am a member of United States Army, currently working with United States International Security Assistance Force and Fleet Anti-Terrorism Security Team.
Okay.
So Leroy has a site, has an ad on a site for mentally ill people who are lonely.
Well, you could have PSD.
Yeah, okay. Let's, you know, it's the Chilpack Hollywood red flag of the week.
Our new segment. I love it.
And okay. Finally, Dean Haglund, turning to the World of Sports Police Blotter.
Well, that's our favorite segment. You know, I follow that.
We so rarely talk about sports with good reason.
Right.
And yet, you know, what I'm struck by was a year ago, I dusted off my soapbox about the San Francisco 49ers.
Right.
And this was a team that was having a rash of criminal charges leveled against its players. There apparently was a conspiracy to cover up, and this conspiracy involved paid off members of the local police department who worked as private security for the team. This was all a year ago. This is old news. Okay.
Right.
And at the time, one of the things that happened was a campaign by the owner and the general manager, the owner Jed York, the general manager Trent Baalke, to lay blame squarely at the feet of their very successful winning coach Jim Harbaugh, saying that he was allowing for this culture without any control and any policy conduct policy whatsoever.
Right.
In reality, we now know that that was just part of their effort on the part of the owner and the general manager to start a whisper and smear campaign to get rid of their very winning and high-priced coach who had a contract extension negotiation coming up and who was getting way too much credit in the press for how much that team won. So they were serving to undermine him in every way they could, including writing off their entire season last year by creating dissension in the locker room through all of this. And I bring this up just because what we know now is that that very head coach who was apparently responsible for this culture with no conduct policy whatsoever was in fact several times rebuffed for trying to write and enact a conduct policy. He is no longer with the team, and here we are a year later, back in whatever their training camp is called, their preseason, and two players, criminally charged with differing levels of charges involving sexual assault.
Wow.
And the point that I would like to just make right now for all in Chilpack Nation is do your friend in podcasting, Phil Lairness, a favor. If you support a team, or if those you love and know support a team that has a habitual culture that has proven that they are genuinely a menace to society, can you stop spending your money supporting that team?
That would be easy, one would think. Because there's a plethora of sports entertainment choices in any given city.
And the responsibility is ours. Because if we spend our money and our energy on these teams, then that responsibility of a culture of public menace is on us. Because we've given it our permission and our encouragement to continue. So if the owners and the general managers and the players themselves can't be responsible, and of course, as you know, I'm shocked to find that in a business that is based on the physical exploitation of young men, that violence would somehow ensue.
Right.
The responsibility does lie with us to say, you know what, we're going to spend our money elsewhere.
This reminds me of Amy Schumer's famous sketch, the Friday Night Lights parody of No Raping. You saw that one, didn't you?
I didn't. Please,
oh, my gosh.
Educate me.
A new coach comes to town and he says, I have a strict policy, no raping. And they're all like, coach, come on. What if she's dressed? It's like, and then the town is hating this coach and like people are spitting at him on the street. It's hilarious.
Wow.
And it makes a point. Yeah. It's a very funny sketch that is very pointed to this whole rape culture in sports that exists today.
Hey, let's talk a little bit about movies. Let's do that. Let's bring up the room a little
bit. Right. I'll tell you what I just saw that I'm in love with. The John Schnepp, who's a friend of yours and mine, I think a friend of yours, but you know him as the director of Metalocalypse and other Adult Swim shows. He had a Kickstarter campaign for the documentary on the death of Superman Lives, What Happened, the Tim Burton, Nick Cage Superman movie that...
Oh, man. Yes, I know about that. So you saw this documentary?
Not only did I see it, I had lunch with John Schnepp, and he gave me my own personal DVD copy, which I've watched about four times now. This is a fantastic documentary. And it's his personal obsession. I mean, John has been obsessed about this movie. He's been collecting storyboards, concept art, and he basically has every person involved in the movie, except for Nick Cage, in this documentary talking about it, what the work they did, showing a lot of the pre-visualization work, and explaining how cool it was going to be and why it ultimately didn't happen.
Wow. I can't wait. So it sounds like that's going to be making somebody's best of the year list.
It might very well. Right now he's just showing it in selected theaters where he's been invited to. He was invited to a theater here in Sydney to do a screening, and there was a big special event that I unfortunately was working that night. But I think you can find all about it at where's the website? John Schnepp has his own production company.
Well, why don't I link something? I'll link,
you
something,
link something
about
yeah. that. To see where it's playing somewhere near you.
You know what I hope some people will seek out is a movie, the new movie, that, well, not that new if you live in Europe, but the new movie from Jean-Pierre Jeunet, the director of Amelie and City of Lost Children,
yes.
called The Young and Prodigious T.S. Spivet, which only... now is out in the States, and one of only three theaters, never mind cities, one of only three theaters in the whole country that's showing the movie in its native 3D is the Downtown Independent.
No.
In Los Angeles, because as has been happening with greater and greater degree, Harvey Weinstein got into a pissing match with the director who refused to cut it to make Harvey happy. This is the Oscar-nominated director of Amelie, which, you know, made a lot of money for Harvey.
Yeah.
And so the director said, no, I'm not going to change this. And so Harvey has buried it, has buried the movie. He has cut off his nose to spite his face again, just like with Snowpiercer. And, you know, and everybody, you know, Harvey pats himself on the back about Snowpiercer, saying, look, we made $10 million in VOD, but as a rival executive at a studio said, yeah, but you left $30 million in box office on the table doing so. So it's amazing. But the young and prodigious T.S. Spivet, it really is a very nice family film. It deals with dark themes. It deals with the death of a child. But I got to tell you what I loved. It's not a perfect movie. It's
okay.
But... in fairness to the director, it's not a movie whose flaws would have been solved by cutting it down. It's a movie whose flaws originate from being a satire, a very, very, in some cases, sophisticated satire and commentary on American culture by someone who's an outsider who gets some of the details wrong. Like when he satirizes our talk shows, it really feels a lot like a European talk show, not an American talk show, you know?
Right.
Boy, the satire, the commentary on our gun culture is so subtle and so wonderfully sophisticated and makes a fantastic point. So it's, you know, but the other flaw with the film is, boy, child, casting an unknown child actor is an iffy proposition.
Yeah, that's always tough, isn't it? And I'm reading here the plot summary. I see a 10-year-old cartographer secretly leaves his family ranch in Montana to travel across the country in a freight train to receive an award at the Smithsonian Institute.
Yes.
Now, that to me is a pitch line that I would go, yes, tell me more, if I had a writer sit down in my production office and lay that on me. So it seems great, but as you said, a 10-year-old cartographer, that is an acting challenge for even any actor of any age.
I also saw, you know, apropos of my desire to educate myself in silent films, I saw Paul Lenny's final German film, the 1924 Waxworks.
Oh, where did you find that one?
On Kino Disc. So,
really?
You know, and it's a very interesting, you know, horror film, kind of an anthology horror film, a precursor of so many anthology horror, you know, not only films, but television shows. I also saw a fantastically underrated Otto Preminger film from 1962 called Advise and Consent, and I thought maybe we'd talk about that next week when we get into details with a question that came from our loyal listener, Agent Summer, about supporting actors.
Yes.
Because we talked so much about the art of acting last week and what we look for and what makes great acting. And, of course, we love supporting players. And so Agent Summer wrote us, hello, Phil and Down Under Dean. Although, as we established last week, it's Dean Down Haglunder. On last week's podcast, you discussed Maya Rudolph as a gifted performer who delights you each time you see her. For some reason, this got me to thinking about some other actors and actresses who also seem to bring it every time you see them on screen. As I thought about it, many of them are not the star of the movie or show, but are often character actors. And some of my favorites include Maggie Smith, Brad Dourif, and the fabulous CCH Pounder. Each time you see their names in the credits, you can be assured scenes with them will be absolutely memorable, even if the rest of the work does not necessarily measure up. It could be said that Dean has some experience in the character acting department, since Langley certainly started out that way and would become so beloved by X-Files fans. So she wanted us to bring some insight into, you know, the responsibilities that a supporting player brings and to some of the supporting players whose work we admire. And I also thought I could take a few minutes to talk about how the economics of the business really work against the idea of having many of these great supporting actors for very long, because really you either need to move up to starring your own thing or you go right back to working for scale, you know? So why don't we take some time, maybe jot down some names of some ones you admire that are...
Well, but let me start first by having an example of just as you're saying now of supporting players being so critical and yet so hard to find, particularly when the scale of economics goes through the roof. And I'm not referring to a movie right now, but a play over in London called Hamlet with Mr. Cumberbatch, Benedict Cumberbatch, playing the lead role, and yet the reviews are atrocious because all the supporting players are completely out of his league. And you think in a town of London's caliber, of all the acting schools churning them out, that they could have cast the caliber supporting players to be on stage with Mr. Benedict. But in fact, probably, as I'm guessing, the money was so expensive to have him play Hamlet that they had no money left but to hire just basic day equity guys straight out of school or who have no talent whatsoever and basically crush the production totally, which is sad. And, you know, this is a story that you hear again and again.
Well, I think this will be a great conversation to have, maybe even give over half the show to it next week. You know, again, your connection to the X-Files, it's interesting. If you go back to the classic, you know, so many of those episodes, you know, they've so often featured great supporting character actors in guest starring roles.
Yeah, who later went on to, you know, become leading guys in themselves.
Or, and to the contrary, by the later seasons, and I think it was a little bit to the series' detriment, you started having lead actors come and guest on the show instead of character actors. You know, you started to have the Luke Wilsons, you started to have the Burt Reynolds, you have, and I'm not saying that those shows were not delightful, but it wasn't the same as, you know, that ambiance, that atmosphere of really being able to believe the world. So much to talk about that, but you know what we have to do this week, Dean?
What's that?
I have to do the opening salvo of our analysis, our film-by-film analysis of
Yay.
The film fatales list of the recent women-directed movies that everyone should see, and the all-time great female-directed films that inspire the work of Film Fatales. And Film Fatales, again, is a collective of female directors and filmmakers in chapters in cities around the world. And I watched a film that debuted at the Sundance Film Festival this year, the second feature film from Jennifer Fang. I met Jennifer at Outfest when Karl Rove, I Love You, my film, was playing there. Her debut feature, Half-Life, was playing there. And it featured, that film, a supporting turn from a young man named Alexander Agate, who, of course, was the little boy in the movie you and I made together, Spectres.
Ah.
It was with great delight that I read about her getting to make her second film. It debuted at Sundance, as I said. It was bought for exclusive distribution by Netflix, who released it to theaters and onto their own streaming server on day and date on June 23rd or 26th of this summer, I believe. And it is a science fiction film that is written by Jennifer Fang and her leading lady, Jacqueline Kim, the great actress Jacqueline Kim, who is a local resident here of the Tony neighborhood of Los Feliz in Los Angeles.
Yeah,
and who's so famous to sci-fi audiences, of course, for playing Sulu's daughter in the Star Trek feature film Generations. This movie... I'll set the stage for you. Some kids are coming out of school in what you think might be New York, because this high rise in this neighborhood looks a lot like New York. And as they come around a corner, you see smoke emerging from one of the high rises. You catch yourself because you're gasping and going, oh my God, it's 9/11. Because it looks so much like when the first tower had the impact.
Ah.
And then you see spaceships heading towards it to respond. And the kids say, well, before the spaceships, the kids say, oh, no, not again. And then the spaceships head towards it. And that's the introduction that we're in the future. And it is a future where so many jobs are better done by artificial intelligences, by computer, by technology. All of which remains unseen, though not unheard. You might call, for example, a helpline. You might call what would you call it? Customer service.
Customer service. Yeah.
Only if you're really savvy and listening, does it begin to dawn on you that you're not talking to a person. And if you ask, "Am I talking to a real person?" they might ask you, "Well, how do you define a real person?" And so many jobs are taken because they're better done by technology that the economy really, really has changed. It's one where a small group of people own all the wealth and the majority of the people have very little to speak of. So much different than today.
Yeah, that's weird. How sci-fi.
And so what is being decided more or less is, you know, we got to phase out women from the workplace, because if we phase out men and they're on the street, they may just get agitated and do something about it, whereas women won't have the wherewithal.
Wow.
So it is a film about where women will fit into that future society. A future society so unlike ours, where men are scared of losing their relevancy. So different from ours today, where men are threatened by women's place in the workplace. So different from
so
today.
Different.
So a wonderfully intriguing film, a beautiful film at times, a moving film, a great cast. And is it a perfect film? No. And but the flaws in it often enough are not flaws of conception, writing, or execution, but rather they show the fact that look, even when good people are making a good script into a film, it's still really, really hard. Because what works on the page may not work visually when it's brought to life and
right.
might need to be changed. But if it's an issue of kind of structure, there's nothing you can do about it. And so I guess what I'm saying is that it may work structurally on the page, but visually that structure might not work anymore. But the film does regain itself in the third act. It's just a momentary misstep of maybe 10 or 15 minutes. So I couldn't recommend it more strongly. It's Advantageous by Jennifer Fang, and it's the first of the recent women-directed films that everyone should see that we're talking about for Chilpac Nation.
Excellent. Well, I'll then hop on that list and find something to watch and report in next week.
And maybe it'll be something with great supporting actors. Who knows?
Maybe. I'll tie that all in.
You know what does tie into what I just described, though, was a study that was released, and I guess is released every year by the Directors Guild, about the best and worst television shows for female and minority directors.
Ah.
And let me just sum up this study by saying, you really don't want to be a female or a minority director in television.
Oh, really?
It's pretty sad. You know, there. Let's do just some numbers, right?
Okay.
Right here,
yes.
Okay? Because, you know, stats can be used any number of ways. But let's point out there were more episodes of television made last year than ever before. There were almost 4,000 episodes of television. Because think of all the networks. Think of all the shows, right?
Right.
A 10% increase in total episodes over the previous year, which set the record.
Wow.
And
how many of those are filmed in L.A.?
I don't know about that. That's a different conversation.
Yes, it is. Sorry.
And more jobs were generated, more directing jobs for women than ever before, with 618 of the almost 4,000 episodes being directed by women. Now, you know, correct me if I'm wrong. This is the Directors Guild of America, and isn't 52% of the population women in America?
Somewhere in there.
Yeah.
Or 51.
It's more women than men. Now, I'm not saying that there's more women than men in the DGA. Of course there aren't. We know that. But I'm just saying 618 out of 4,000, we got a long, long way to go. but that did represent a 21% year-over-year growth rate. Unfortunately, the number for minority directors, directors of color, let's say, went way down to almost an all-time low. So it's overall not very good, and it's crazy because there are so many more shows. And it seems to me that if you're a hit show, hire first-time directors. Those are the shows that should be giving an opportunity to first-time directors.
Yeah, absolutely.
Not shows that are struggling. The shows that really are already up and running and have a formula, have a format, have seasoned professionals in charge. Why aren't you people giving an opportunity to first-time directors?
Well, now, I thought there was a rule in place like the WGA where they had to hire two new writers. I thought the DGA had a similar rule where first-time directors were apprenticing technically on TV shows that are five seasons or more. Is that not in place?
I guess probably. Well, if they are, those first-time directors are white men. Because, look, 27 shows, 27, Dean Haglund.
That's a lot.
Had zero episodes directed by women or minorities. 27 shows had all their episodes directed by white men. And HBO is the worst offender. of this.
Is that right?
So many, from The Brink and The Comeback and Banshee and what's the one? Boardwalk Empire. Not a single woman or director of ethnicity whatsoever in there. And honestly, almost 46 shows, 46 series had less than 10% of their episodes directed. If you go to the good news category, right?
Yes,
which
please.
I guess I'm going to call 50%, having 50%, because what percentage of the population are white men? 25% of the population?
I don't know those numbers.
Let's just say, for shits and giggles, 25%. But we'll acknowledge that, of course, a larger percentage of the DGA is at this point white men.
Okay.
So let's say 50% is a great number of episodes to have go to women and minorities. Well, there's only 30 shows that achieve even that paltry number.
Wow.
And when you think that one of those shows is not a show like Black-ish, that show, the vast majority of its episodes are directed by white men.
Really?
Yeah, you know, it's so interesting and disappointing, obviously, but it's also just a huge missed opportunity because storytelling is more interesting, right? Especially on television, where it is such a collaborative environment, when you have differing points of view and experiences.
Yeah, well, that's what you want. You want that wide range to come in to embolden and make the project better. I mean, that's what you learn in ensemble acting. I can't believe it's not done in television production.
So we just have a couple of moments left to finally get to speaking of diversity or the lack thereof. For the first time in a long, long time since before you fled to Australia on the Botany Bay, it's time for a lawsuit of the week.
Ah!
The Chill Pack Hollywood Lawsuit of the Week.
Thank you, Garrett Watley.
Yay!
In February, media mogul Byron Allen... I remember Byron Allen as a comic and a TV show host, and now he's a media mogul.
I didn't realize that.
Media mogul Byron Allen filed a $20 billion Ouch. Lawsuit against Comcast, Time Warner, the NAACP, and Reverend Al Sharpton.
Wow, guns a-blazing.
I don't want to go into all the details here, but the lawsuit alleges... that he and other black producers and cable programming providers and networks that are wholly or mostly owned by African Americans have been intentionally blocked out, boxed out by the major cable providers, and that both the NAACP and Al Sharpton have been paid off to look the other way.
What?
I mean, those are some specific charges. And
really specific. And hard to prove, I would think.
Well, and so initially, much of this lawsuit was dismissed. Well, okay. The very judge who dismissed it, not so long later, here we are just a few months after he dismissed it, that same judge has reversed himself and said that this trial should very much go forward.
Wow, what changed his mind?
That I don't know, but
there's got to be evidence.
It certainly bears I'll look into it a little bit more closely. But I did want to get that out there since we were talking about diversity and
absolutely. And the shocker is Al Sharpton. I mean, I wouldn't think he has that much influence, but I guess he does.
And
so
he's the one that appeared on. Look, we don't have. I believe. In my heart of hearts, as we talked about when Sully McCullough guested last December at a certain historic building in downtown Los Angeles, we don't have a Black Annie movie if it isn't for the Reverend Al Sharpton and his guest appearance on Boston Legal, where Alan Shore is defending someone who's suing the Broadway revival of Annie because her daughter wasn't given a fair shake because she was black. So it's a lawsuit with very little merits. And so Denny Crane tells Alan Shore he needs to pull a rabbit. And Denny and Alan Shore has no idea what that means, thinks it's Denny just being crazy with the pre-dementia. And all of a sudden, in the midst of him floundering, Al Sharpton walks into the courtroom with a bunch of reporters in tow and gives an impassioned, give us a black Annie, give us a black Spider-Man, set us free at last, free at last. And as he finishes his oratory, he leans over to Alan Shore, and says, that's pulling a rabbit, Denny Crane. It's a great moment on television, so I certainly don't want to believe that the Reverend Al could be responsible for preventing us from getting a black Spider-Man.
Oh, God, I hope not. I want to see this lawsuit now.
So I will research this and look into it in more detail. But that brings us to an end of another action-packed
indeed.
Freewheeling installment of your Chillpack Hollywood Hour. Dean, you know, people can find every installment of their Chillpack Hollywood Hour at chillpackhollywood.com.
Spelled C-H-I-L-L-P-A-K Hollywood.com.
Download them, stream them, subscribe via iTunes.
Even write a review on iTunes.
What could be more fun? And, of course, people can and should write us if they have something that they want us to talk about or if they want us to join their dating website, chillpackhollywood@yahoo.com. Like us on Facebook. We're facebook.com/chillpackhollywood.
Follow us on Twitter.
How do they do that?
At Dean and Phil. Spell out the and part too.
Until next week, I'm Phil Lernis. Take care of yourself, Dean Haglund.
I will. You have a great evening. I'm going to watch the sunset here on tomorrow.
I don't know what that means. All right. Be good, everybody. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Belated spoiler alert.